by half a degree, and suddenly 5.9% of Americans could deal with rising sea levels. If it goes up by 3 degrees Celsius or 4 degrees Celsius, 7.9% or 9.9% of the American population could see rising sea levels where they live. Things will be particularly bad in the New York City, where officials are already considering sea walls and other measures to fortify its population against rising sea levels. Even under the most ambitious Paris Agreement target, land will fall under the high tide line that is currently home to 6.7% of the population. At 2 degrees Celsius, that rises to 13%. At 3 degrees Celsius, it reaches 19%. And at 4 degrees Celsius, it hits 28%. The most vulnerable region, however, is Asia. 9 of the 10 megacities at the highest risk are on that continent. And many of the countries with the starkest projections are also located there. The jump from 1.5 degrees Celsius to 2 degrees Celsius makes a difference in Vietnam and Bangladesh, between more or less than half of their total populations living below the high tide line. If the planet's temperature rises to 4 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, more than 60% of those nations' populations could fall below the high tide line. More than 30% of the populations of Egypt, Thailand, Malaysia, Delhi, Philippines, Japan, Myanmar would also suffer that fate in a scenario where the temperature rises by more than 4 degrees Celsius. Climate Central has also stressed visual illustrations of how prominent American landmarks will look after sea level rises. Almost all of the land around the Statue of Liberty National Monument will be submerged, as will the area surrounding Space Center Houston. Yet these and other major landmarks would almost certainly have to be abandoned long before sea levels rose that high, as there will be an increase in heavy rainfalls and storm surges.
Unemployment in the Gaza Strip.
How's your work? What have you accomplished? Not much. We stopped the construction of the house because of the construction materials crisis in the Gaza Strip. There are no construction materials available, no cement, no steel, and no whitewash. Most construction materials stopped entering the Strip due to the Egyptian army's military operations in the Sinai. In addition, they have already destroyed most of the tunnels between Egypt and Gaza, through which all materials used to enter. Now they have disappeared from the local market. On the other hand, Israel has been blocking all crossings to the Gaza Strip for 7 years.
When we decided to expose the problem of unemployment in the Gaza Strip, we were confused about a starting point, but we met with an informative colleague, Mr. Atif Isa, who paved the way for us. He told us about his suffering over 7 years in building his dream house, which is still under construction at the moment. According to his plan, he was supposed to be done 5 years ago.
According to my house plan, the house is supposed to be ready now, and I would have moved into it. But as you can see, it seems to be ready from the outside, but work still needs to be done. These days, I am supposed to have at least 5 or 6 teams working at the same time. These teams provide job opportunities to about 30 or 40 workers. That means there are 30 to 40 families that used to have income, but not anymore because I have stopped the building of my house. I'm the head of a family of 6 people. All I want is a job opportunity, and everything will go fine with me. I wish other workers could work too, like the old days of working in a team. There were supposed to be more than 20 workers working on this scaffolding. However, there are only 2 or 3 people because of the shortage in construction materials. Their being here is inconsistent. As you can see, no improvements seem to occur.
These 2 workers are the only ones among over 30 who continued working here to make a living. Ibrahim, Raed's colleague and cousin, is the only one who remained to work with him, doing some modest jobs, despite knowing very well that he's not the right person in the right place.
I have learned the Holy Quran by heart and studied at private schools. Then I pursued my study in Malaysia at East Asia University. My major was the Prophet's Hadiths. After that, I came back to Gaza. As you can see, I work in construction. We have no chance to work in related fields. The crossings are blocked, and there aren't any projects or development. There is nothing. There are approximately 35,000 unemployed graduates. Because of the blockade, this number has risen in light of the rapid increase in the number of graduates from the Palestinian and Arab universities. This means that there is a large number of graduates per year. More than 10,000 graduates join the previous number of the unemployed because of the lack of opportunities.
Hamza Hassan from the beach refugee camp has joined the army of the unemployed after 4 years of study in the English literature department at the Faculty of Arts. 2 years after graduation, he lives a conflict between dreaming of his certificate and looking for any job, even if it's not related to his field of study.
I graduated from university after 4 years of studying English literature. I and most of the other young people were surprised with the fact that there are no work opportunities. Even if one does not want to work in one's field of study, it is hopeless. Youth also suffer from boredom. Young people spend some time out, just like myself. We spend most of our time in having food, sleeping, and hanging out.
The Gaza Strip is surrounded by 7 crossings. The Rafah crossing is the only one connecting the Gaza Strip with an Arab country, Egypt. But the other 6 crossings are fully controlled by the Israeli occupation. And most of them are completely blocked most of the time. The only commercial crossing left partially open is the Kerem Shalom crossing. It is controlled by the Israeli soldiers Mood.
The needs of the Gaza Strip exceed 800 trucks a day. Meanwhile, the Israeli occupation prevents more than 480 to 500 trucks from entering Gaza. These goods are very important for the development of the Palestinian economy and include all raw materials machinery, and equipment required for the development of the economy or solving the problems of production lines. I am Majid Abdul Hafiz Abu Salim. I own a sewing factory that produces bags. This bag factory has stopped working for a long time because of the siege and the occupation. This is a leather sewing machine that we use in producing leather bags. All these machines as well. As you see, they are all off. There were 12 to 15 workers. However, after the blockade, the factory has stopped. All the workers have lost their jobs and spend their time at home or in hanging out. I used to work as a tailor. I haven't worked for almost 9 years now because of the siege, the blockade, and the Israeli restrictions. I have 6 daughters, 3 sons, and there's my wife and I. I cannot fulfill their needs. We're currently living by help and aid. Our life is very difficult, and the unemployment rate has become great. When school started, I didn't buy new bags, clothes, or anything for my kids because I was not ready to buy them their school needs and let them suffer hunger later. Thank God I'm not renting my house. May Allah help those who rent. I am not renting, though I suffer very much. I am a deported prisoner, and I am renting a house. Currently, my family lives by relief supplies and aid. There isn't a job opportunity, and the situation is really difficult. As you see, I have 6 kids. Come in, please. This is one of my 6 kids. Please come in. This is Muhammad. He is sick. What does he suffer from? He has convulsions, epilepsy, mental retardation, and speech difficulties. If he walks along the street, he wouldn't know where he is going. Every time he goes out by himself, I go bring him from a different place.
My sister-in-law has got rid of this closet, and I thought of removing my kids' clothes into it instead of being on the floor. All the kids' clothes are damaged. If my husband had a job with a monthly income of $200, not $400, it would be enough to pay for the owner of the house the first month. And the next month, we could buy a closet like most of the people. We could buy a bed for ourselves. We had a bed and a closet when we got married, but we sold them to afford the housing rent because the house owners would kick us out. They're not tolerant and they would ask for their money. The house does not have appropriate doors or windows, but we had no choice.
I tried to get a job. I worked as a taxi driver, but it wasn't helping because of the fuel crisis. And if you want to do something else, it must be at the expense of your health. I used to work in construction, but construction has stopped in the strip. The crossings are all blocked, and the situation is very bad. The construction materials are very expensive and rare. I am sick and can't do tiring work. In winter, water reaches up to this level. Even when I tried to make a hole in the wall to let the water out, some of the street water started flooding and its level was higher than the kids' knees. We used to fill 6 or 7 buckets with water to get rid of it. People like winter, but I don't. I don't like it because it is tiring. This is our kitchen. The walls are cracked because of the rocket shelling during the war.
The Shaban's house is already cracked by poverty and also by the missiles of the 2 wars on Gaza, the 2008-2009 war and the late 2012 war. The Israeli rockets accurately hit targets other than the Shaban's house. They destroyed nearly 1,000 of a total of 4,000 industrial facilities. Many of the rest have completely stopped working due to the blockade imposed on the Gaza Strip since mid-2007.
This factory was working in the metals.
This factory used to work in concrete in the Gaza Strip. It provided job opportunities to about 70 workers. During the pre-war period, we had 17 mixing vehicles and 7 concrete pumps. 10 of these vehicles were destroyed, and only 7 remained. In spite of this, I want to bring this factory to life again to make a living. I want to contribute to the reconstruction of Gaza, but now there are small quantities of goods entering Gaza. More than 3,900 factories have stopped either completely or partly as a result of the prevention of raw materials and production requirements from coming in. Moreover, the Israeli occupation bombed many industrial facilities during the last two wars on the Strip. Most of the destroyed institutions started having problems with any production process. This made more than 45,000 workers, only in the field of production and industry, lose their jobs, which has led to an increase in unemployment.
With the siege tightening and factories systematically destroyed by the Israeli occupation, Gazans are tempted to break the siege through digging underground tunnels along the border with Egypt to bring in their daily needs of food and medications, as well as raw materials that may contribute to operating some industrial facilities in one way or another.
Many industrial institutions and laborers were working when some of the materials were allowed in through the tunnels. This softened the effects of the siege on the Strip. These tunnels, or the ground crossings as we call them, provided job opportunities to 35,000 workers in the construction sector and other industrial sectors through the entry of raw materials. My basic profession is sewing. As you know, sewing is not common now. We used to have orders from the north of Palestine. The crossings are blocked now, and there are no exchanges with Israel. In general, the sewing profession has stopped now, and I came to Rafah. In Rafah, there were opportunities and tunnels. Our area of concentration was construction materials, and especially gravel. Lately, transporting gravel has become difficult, so we started transporting goods. Merchants started providing us with goods through the tunnels. We rebuilt the factory. It used to give jobs to 70 employees. Now we are running one factory with one operational capacity. There used to be 70 people, but now there are only 30.
Tunnels became a lifeline for the residents of the Gaza Strip. The economy began to recover, and unemployment rates were significantly reduced, either because of work in the tunnels or the supply of goods, especially with thousands of tons of cement, steel, and gravel arriving daily. All of that led to dozens of large enterprises, including the reconstruction of Gaza after the Israeli destruction of thousands of houses and public facilities. But all of these improvements have stopped with the demolition of the tunnels. Gaza became besieged again, causing the unemployment rates to increase.
There is destruction in tunnels. Every day, a cement or steel tunnel is destroyed. The tunnel line requires at least 20 workers. It may be more, but there are not less than 20. The Egyptians said they have destroyed 350 tunnels. This is what has been destroyed. We don't know whether they have destroyed the rest or not. They have demolished 300 or 360 tunnels, each requiring 20 workers. This means that a total of about 6,000 workers are now unemployed. Relying on tunnels was not on the agenda of the Palestinians. This means bringing in food, clothes, and medication through the tunnels. But the phenomenon was forced on the Gazans, leaving them with no choice. Thus began the circle of providing jobs to the deprived in construction and production factories because of the Israeli restrictions. When Egyptian security takes an action in this regard, along with not allowing these materials to officially enter the strip, the problem of unemployment will become worse. I was doing well, and now I've got 30 workers. However, if tunnels remain blocked, I will reduce the number to half because there are no goods coming in. I recently divided the workers into two groups. Each works for 15 days. If the situation remains the same, I may lay off 15 workers, and I will cause the destruction of 15 families. I was working for a short period of time. Now I have stopped because there is no cement. I have 13 people in my house. Four of my sons are unemployed. They are all illiterate. No one else is employed. I have to take care of my daughters, my wife, and my daughters-in-law. The situation used to be different. There were job opportunities, and life went on. We used to work and make a living for the family. Life was better. Nowadays, the situation is different because there are no goods or cement, the crossings are blocked, and there's a siege imposed. I don't use the work equipment I have, and I have to afford the living expenses of 13 people.
Everybody is unemployed. There is no chance for construction workers, laborers, and contractors. They're all unemployed. Where will they find jobs? Even employees are complaining about the hard situation. If you intend to borrow some money from an employee, he will tell that his salary is hardly enough for him and his children. For those who receive salaries at the end of the month, they keep telling that's not enough. An employee's salary is $400. Is it enough? The doctor with a certificate does not find work, as well as the engineer. Are there any projects or hospitals that provide work chances? Let new factories open to help workers find a chance. Is there electricity for factory work? If there were factories and construction projects, no one would need anyone else. We wouldn't need anything from the Israeli occupation, and no one would starve, because when a worker gets a chance, sometimes it's going to be much better than an employee's.
أنا كان في مشروع تطوير البحر وبالتالي توسع.
There was a project to develop the beach, thus expanding the street by the beach, but the work stopped. Look at this sidewalk. They are supposed to be paving another lane of the street. During the time I spent heading to the office or going home, I used to see many machines, engineers, and laborers working on the project. However, they aren't working anymore due to the lack of construction materials and fuel. This caused the company to stop the development of the street. In addition, many of the workers and engineers who used to work on the project stopped and became a part of the unemployed sector that already existed in the Gaza Strip.
The continuous closure of tunnels and the border crossings does not only exacerbate the high rates of unemployment, it also severely affects the performance of factories, the supply, the local market with many essential products.
After stopping our work and having it ruined, you can see that we are hunting for work and making a wallet or repairing a bag, just like that. During the past 6 months, we noticed a slowdown in the sectors of clothes and sewing. That happened because of the lack of activation. You can add to this the productive and service sectors. They would be severely affected, and we would go back to the time, before 3 or 4 years ago, when there was great unemployment, a lack of goods and materials needed daily, and a growing crisis in many sectors that would unfortunately worsen the humanitarian and social problems in the Gaza Strip. I was affected anyway. I cannot even fulfill the requirements of my customers or serve their interests. I pack gravel, but I can't do the same with cement. However, there is no cement, and when it is available, I can work with other workers. You can see that nobody works. Cars do not work, or employees either. Some workers come here seeking a chance at work, but I tell them there are no construction materials. If you can bring me any materials in the local market, I am ready to give you a chance at work. I've got the money and the intention. I am also in a hurry. I need to move to my new house. Today we ordered the bricks. The factory said that the bricks are not ready because there is no cement. I have been asking a blacksmith to build me a stair rod. The blacksmith agrees to make me one, but says we should agree on something first. He asks for extra money. When I ask about the reason, he says because there is no steel.
Freezing of small or large projects, the obstruction of industrial facilities, and the increase of the unemployment rate to more than 40% are all considered disasters that threaten to affect a wide range of the population of the Gaza Strip.
I and my sister-in-law were in the kitchen. My son was standing here, and my sister-in-law's sons were there. I was preparing milk for my son, and he was catching my clothes crying. The boiling pan slipped from my hand and burnt it. I should have gone to the hospital, but I couldn't afford it. I didn't have $1 to go to the hospital. I had a bacterium in the blood, and the doctor told me that this infection was caused by a polluted environment. I told him about the condition of our house, and during winter, my house becomes full of water. He said that was the reason. I recently had some analysis and found that I have problems in my chest. The doctor said I need medical treatment, and the prescription contained only two pills that cost $30, and I can't afford buying one. How would I buy those pills? The doctor gave it to me for free once because he knows about my situation. He also treats my patient's son and follows his case. He paid for the medication that time, but how would I afford paying for the rest? How can I buy two pills for $30?
The Palestinians are steadfast and patient people. They have been suffering, but they are aware that the main reason is the Zionist occupation. The occupation has been trying to suppress the Palestinians, but we say that they are patient, steadfast, and will continue to be so. They will keep fighting the occupier with their steadfastness and an honorable attitude opposing these conspiracies. بصموده وبوقفته المشرفة ضد هذه المؤامرات.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
the limelight.
A nurse testified before a Georgia Senate study committee in September that she was attacked by a patient so severely last spring she landed in the ER of her own hospital. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written jointly by Bram Sabel Smith and Andy Miller researchers. This article is published under the heading U.S. Hospital Workers Report Rising Violence Throughout Pandemic. Stay tuned for more. In the earliest days of the pandemic, nightly celebrations lauded the bravery of frontline healthcare workers. 18 months later, those same workers say they are experiencing an alarming rise in violence in the workplaces. A nurse testified before a Georgia Senate study committee in September that she was attacked by a patient so severely last spring she landed in the ER of her own hospital. At Research Medical Center in Kansas City, Missouri, security was called to the COVID unit, said nurse Jen Caldwell, when a visitor aggressively yelled at their nursing staff about the condition of his wife, who was a patient. In Missouri, a tripling of physical assaults against nurses prompted Cox Medical Center Branson to issue panic buttons that can be worn on employees' identification badges. Hospital executives were already attuned to workplace violence before the pandemic struck. But the stresses from COVID have exacerbated the problem, they say, prompting increased security, de-escalation training, and pleas for civility. And while many hospitals work to address the issue on their own, nurses and other workers are pushing federal legislation to create enforceable standards nationwide. Paul Sarnes, an executive at Virtua Health in New Jersey and president of the International Association for Healthcare Security and Safety, said many studies show healthcare workers are much more likely to be victims of aggravated assault than workers in many other industries. Federal data shows health workers faced 73% of all non-fatal injuries from workplace violence in the U.S. in 2018. It's too early to have comprehensive stats from the pandemic. Even so, Michelle Wallace, chief nursing officer at Grady Health System in Georgia, said the violence is likely even higher because many victims of patient assaults don't report them. We say this is part of our job, said Wallace, who advocates for more reporting. Caldwell said she had been a nurse for less than 3 months the first time she was assaulted at work. A patient spit at her. In the 4 years since, she estimated she hasn't gone more than 3 months without being verbally or physically assaulted. Caldwell said, I wouldn't say that it's expected, but it is accepted. We have a lot of people with mental health issues that come through our doors. Jackie Gatz, Vice President of Safety and Preparedness for the Missouri Hospital Association, said a lack of behavioral health resources can spur violence as patients seek treatment for mental health issues and substance use disorders in ERs. Life can also spill inside to the hospital, with violent episodes that began outside, continuing inside, or the presence of law enforcement officers, escalating tensions. A February 2021 report from National Nurses United, a union in which both Camara and Caldwell are representatives, offers another possible factor. Staffing levels that don't allow workers sufficient time to recognize and de-escalate possibly volatile situations. COVID unit nurses also have shouldered extra responsibilities during the pandemic. Duties such as feeding patients, drawing blood, and cleaning rooms would typically be conducted by other hospital staffers, but nurses have pitched in one of those jobs to minimize the numbers of workers visiting the negative pressure rooms where COVID patients are treated. While the workload has increased, the number of patients each nurse oversees is unchanged, leaving little time to hear the concerns of visitors scared for the well-being of their loved ones, like the man who aggressively yelled at the nurses in Caldwell's unit. In September, 31% of hospital nurses surveyed by that union said they had faced workplace violence, up from 22% in March. Dr. Brice Garland, hospital group president of Atlanta-based Emory Healthcare, said violence has escalated as the pandemic has worn on, particularly during the latest wave of infections, hospitalizations, and deaths. Garland said frontline healthcare workers and first responders have been on the battlefield for 18 months. They are exhausted. Like the increase in violence on airplanes, at sports arenas, and school board meetings, the rising tensions inside hospitals could be a reflection of the mounting tensions outside them. William Mahoney, president of Cox Medical Center Branson, said national political anger is acted out locally, especially when staffers ask people who come into the hospital to put on a mask. Caldwell, the nurse in Kansas City, said the physical nature of COVID infections can contribute to an increase in violence. Patients in the COVID unit often have dangerously low oxygen levels. People have different political views. They are either CNN or Fox News, and they start yelling at you, screaming at you, Mahoney said. When that happens, they become confused and also extremely combative, Caldwell said. Sarnacy said the pandemic has given hospitals an opportunity to revisit their safety protocols. Limiting entry points to enable COVID screening, for example, allows hospitals to funnel visitors past security cameras. Research Medical Center recently hired additional security officers and provided de-escalation training to supplement its video surveillance, spokesperson Christine Hamel said. In Branson, Mahoney's hospital has bolstered its security staff, mounted cameras around the facility, brought in dogs. People don't really want to swing at you when there is a German Shepherd sitting there, and conducted de-escalation training in addition to the panic buttons. Some of those efforts predate the pandemic, but the COVID-19 crisis has added urgency to an industry already struggling to recruit employees and maintain adequate staffing levels. The number one question we started getting asked is, "Are you going to keep me safe?" Mahoney said. Doc Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Whose Streets, directed by Sabah Folayan and Damon Davis. And joining me in the studio, we have Rich Klein, who is the Vice Chair of the London Film Critics Circle and Chair of the Critics Circle Film Awards. And beside him is Lee Jasper, who is a former policing director for London and social justice campaigner. He is also a Black Sox sponsor, which was formed in 2015 as a result of events concerning the increasing levels of violence impacting London's black communities. Now, Whose Streets is an unflinching look at the Ferguson uprising in the US state of Missouri. The uprising sparked nationwide protests the day after the fatal shooting of Michael Brown by white police officer Darren Wilson on August 9, 2014. Now, filmed on the front line of the clashes, this documentary captures the explosions, the tear gas, and the military-style police vehicles up close. And at the same time, the film also manages to show the anger and sense of outrage that the heavy-handed response provoked.
Anybody growing up here, you tangibly know when you cross the county line, you got to drive a little differently. Your behavior changes because you know how policing changes.
Ferguson police just killed a man in front of my apartment.
People flooded in it earlier have some experience with police.
Things have never been right for black folks in America.
We're trying to mourn, and you came here with 300 cop cars, right, here in canine units.
You gonna shoot me too?
But that ain't the story that you hear about.
This movement was born in love.
We are raising activists. If there's going to be any change, it starts with our children.
This is going to be my fighter right here. Come here.
Welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, this documentary provides a really great insight into the racial tensions of the black community in Ferguson and the police and the issue of police brutality is brought up. And we also get incredible access of the residents themselves to express their struggle from their point of view. Rich, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on Whose Streets?
The film is very specifically about Ferguson. It's not a general film about policing in America or Black Lives Matter or any of the bigger issues. It's very, very specifically about Ferguson. It does obviously touch on much bigger issues as a result. So it feels like a really important document, but it's not as easy to watch as a film. It doesn't have a central narrative line. It has a lot of great characters in it, people that it explores. Mm-hmm. But the thing that makes it really, really worth watching is the footage in it. It's full of incredibly shot footage on people's phones and their own private cameras right on the streets in the middle of all of these riots and all of the tensions and the back and forth of everything going on. So it's showing us a side of the story that the media never showed, because the media kind of took a very slanted view of this whole thing. And
the documentary highlights this.
The documentary contrasts the footage that was shot in the streets with what the media showed the public, and that's very interesting. Mm-hmm. And I think that makes the film definitely worth seeing.
So as Rich was saying, it is an incredibly big topic with lots of layers, especially on the issue of racism, police brutality, and American gun violence, and so forth. Lee, if I could turn to you now, what's your take on these sorts of films, and why are they important?
I think it's an important part of documentation of the struggle of ordinary communities against excessive police violence and institutionalized racism, and that part, you know, it forms an essential documentary narrative around detailing their particular stories from a human perspective. Each individual family is looked at and goes into some detail. So it really gives you the full 3D picture of what a community under pressure from police racism and violence looks like, feels like, smells like, how they respond personally, how it affects their personal lives and the communities around them. And for that, I think it's an important part of social documentary.
But as Rich was saying, this documentary largely focuses on Ferguson. Mm. But as we know, the African American community have been plagued by police brutality for decades. But what is it that made the Ferguson uprising so different?
I think it's a combination of things, really. I think that by the time 2014 comes along and the impact on new technology, on people's understanding of justice and struggle, and the extent to which we now see people capturing inappropriate policing incidents on their own mobile phones, gives this a unique feel because it's from 1,001 different perspectives. If anything, this film is almost like a people's film made up of huge numbers of individual filmmakers who captured various scenes, and they've tried to knit it together in the way that has been described. So I think new technology, I think Hands Up, Don't Shoot, and the Black Lives Matter all emanated from it. I think people were tired of an Obama rhetoric which was about equality but seemed very little in terms of holding police to be accountable at a local level. And the images themselves were so deeply resonant of the black experience and the African-American experience in the United States as to sort of re-excite an embryonic civil rights movement. The scenes we saw on black and white and colour pictures of police brutality and victims in Ferguson in 2014 could have been Ferguson 1964, yeah. And that was the power of their message.
And the power of relevance today, exactly. Yeah. Rip, so one observer in the documentary calls the clash between the police and the black community a, quote, unseen war. And it's been reported that $11 million was reportedly spent on law enforcement connected to the Ferguson uprising. Do you think the film is successful in showing how aggressive the policing is?
I think it really does. I mean, on the one side, it shows how these people just come to the street just saying, how can you shoot an unarmed teenager 10 times? How can the police do this and then try to pretend like it's not an issue? And then the police respond to them coming out into the streets with, I mean, what you saw in the clip was, you know, they're all standing in a line looking really menacing. But later on, they come out with full riot gear and dogs and, you know, snipers on the tops of these giant tanks that are rolling into the streets. It's pretty terrifying because the police just reacted as if the public, who are just desperately crying out saying, don't treat us like this. The police are reacting as if they're the villains. The general public are the villains. And the film really captures that sense that these people just feel desperate and they don't really have a choice but to riot. They start off with a quiet vigil. It's a candlelight vigil. And their voices get louder and louder and louder because nobody's listening to them. And the police are responding like that.
As it said in the film also that Martin Luther King is quoted as saying, the riots is the way, an act of showing the protest of the unheard. Now, Lee, what do you think of the militarization of the police? Is this an appropriate response to deal with the situation?
Well, it's not in a liberal democracy, in supposedly, you know, the land of the free. I think what we're seeing all over the world, really, in Western democracies, is increasing militarization. And in fact, most Western police services are almost following a sort of Israeli policing model. That seems to be the standard model, to be very heavily militarized. And to have the option of using overwhelming and overpowering force. The policing that we saw in Ferguson was akin to an invasion by a small army of a foreign occupying force seeking to invade another country. The combatants' language was the same, the imagery was the same, and I think it's a very dangerous precedent when the police force, and that's what it is, a force, can militarize itself using the advanced latest equipment available to them of any military in the world for use against civilians.
And it's exactly the point that you raised that actually, because in the film we see an American Palestinian resident of Ferguson, and he used to live in the West Bank, and he said it's no different, the West Bank and Ferguson, in the way they're being treated. Do you think that's a fair point to make?
I think it is a fair point. I think if you look at the administration and dispensation of justice on the West Bank, Gaza, and you begin to look at Ferguson and other areas of the United States, you can see that an apartheid level of justice is being dispensed both in West Bank and in America. And to that extent, Israel and America share a similar approach to tackling minority groups that they dislike intensely, and that is to oppress and police them out of oblivion, really.
I want to talk quickly just how the police are portrayed in this documentary. We see the police officers wearing, some of them wearing bracelets for support for Darren Wilson, who shot Michael Brown. What did you make of this?
Well, I like the fact that they let them speak. It's not a purely one-sided documentary. It does kind of let people speak. But then the things the police said in reaction to this event and to the escalating violence were just all wrong. You know, they basically vilified Mike Brown. They showed, you know, a clip of him stealing something from a shop to say, oh, he was a hardened criminal. Well, it still doesn't mean that you can shoot him 10 times when he's unarmed in the back. I mean, that's crazy. So the way that they spun the story and all of their press conferences and even the comments that they make to the cameras.
But they play the victim.
They play the victim. Themselves. And they act like they're the ones who are being attacked. And it's quite frightening, actually.
Sorry, Lee, you wanted to quickly add something?
I think what also hints to is the vast chasm of perceptions between sections of white America and sections of black America about the nature, scale, of racism and what it means. And I think there's a conversation there that is being conducted through megaphones around a awfully complex and nuanced issue that is reflected in the total lack of understanding, I think, from white America about the reality of racism as it affects African Americans, Latinos, African Muslims, and so on and so forth in the USA. And
I think it's all of white America. I think there's a segment of white America that is just ignorant of the whole thing. There's quite a large segment that is aware of what's going on in this fight.
I think I would agree with you, but I would say that
we
racial
did see
inequality.
A lot of white people in the crowd in support of the black people.
No, absolutely. And I think that's right. But I think that when you look at it over the course of history, that what you find is, despite whites having some theoretical acknowledgement of the existence of racism, racial inequality in America and the UK has gotten worse over every single measure. And so a rhetorical understanding of racism and a practical and a theoretical understanding that gives you the tools to deal with it are two separate things.
Okay, great points there. We'll continue this, just taking a break now.
This was actually the first camera that I got when I first started cop watching. I just put my stickers on it, put a picture on my camera so when the police looking, they could see that cop wash stick on there. Got some walkie-talkies. It's two of them for me. So when I leave, I get one to my wife. So the cops don't come in Canfield, no more, doing none of that crap. They do stranger stuff. And that's because we done changed. We made them change what they doing. That's all I want. Don't give them an opportunity to gun somebody down in the street. Be out there to watch them. I don't go out with no weapons or nothing like that. I go out with my camera. That's my weapon, And the fact is that since the police are not being held accountable, we have to hold them accountable.
So David there with the Cop Watch Initiative. He's quite an endearing and inspirational character. Rich, what did you make of his story and progression?
I enjoyed his story. I like the fact that he's taking a positive approach to it. He's doing something that's really important, and the footage he's capturing is invaluable in making sure that everyone understands what's really going on.
And Lee, what do you make of these sorts of initiatives? Do you think social media helps in the struggle for racial justice?
Incredibly. I think they've made a huge difference, actually, to the optics and the understanding of the reality of racism. And of course, what we saw as a consequence of that type of activism is years later, in-depth studies that showed the Ferguson police force were operating a sort of income-driven arrest policy that targeted poor blacks. And they were almost financially incentivized to racially profile that community. And I think that the cameras and the people and social media and access to it allows our community to get its voice heard.
And Rich, we also see, speaking of cameras actually, we see the coverage of how the hostility of the black community to the mainstream media in this documentary. Yeah. Why do you think they were so hostile?
Well, because the mainstream media covered this as an incident of looting. They didn't cover it as a policeman killed an unarmed teenager. They covered it as, residents of Ferguson are looting their local shops. They covered the wrong story.
And Lee, I just wanted to get your thoughts on this. What do you think of the mainstream media coverage of sort of these movements, Black Lives Matter and police brutality?
I think we saw the same at the Grenfell Tower fire disaster post there, where the mainstream media descended on a community and they were very hostile to them. And I think it's largely because there are so few black and ethnic minority peoples in British newsrooms and US newsrooms. And even where they are there, the narrative seems to be overwhelmingly one of a sort of establishment elite perspective. New technology and these films give us an absolute way of breaking through that monitorium of silence that we've had for so long and allows these fresh voices for justice to percolate into the public consciousness. So I think it's an incredibly exciting time. And the internet may well be the thing that holds policing to account to a greater extent than anything else we've ever done.
So that's a, there's hope in the battle ahead then. That's great. So we're just going to take
as long
a brief now from the discussion.
Good evening. My name is Bernie Frazier, and like all of you all, I'm a Ferguson resident. There are a lot of people in Ferguson who have become very fearful of living in this community. But I would like to help you understand one thing. There are many people who have only been fearful for 2 months. There are more people who have been fearful for 2 decades.
It must have been very awkward for the black police officer to be in that situation, probably feeling very conflicted. I just want to read a statistic about U.S. deaths by police gunfire. And by the Washington Post, it reported that at least 1,000 people were killed in 2017, and it's on track to reach that level. Lee, why do you think the issue of police brutality is such a big problem in the U.S.?
I think it's largely because of the failure of U.S. Justice system to deliver, you know, equitable justice for people who suffered from grievous police assault and brutality. There's been systematic cover-up of those sorts of abuses. We've seen that year after year. 1,000 people dying in 2017, those are the numbers you expect in a small war, somewhere very distant. And it shows the extent to which the process of Jim Crow policing, and that's what it is, it's a Jim Crow-style policing without all of the formality of policy and legislation, but producing equally iniquitous outcomes, is the reality for most black experiences in America. Two-tier justice, apartheid levels of administration of justice, and a gross denial of the reality of racism that just angers and inflames disadvantaged communities.
And in the documentary, we see various references to President Obama at the time, and we get the sense of the frustration that the residents were powerless, even with a black president, that they couldn't get their justice. What did you make of this?
Well, I mean, they say he's not a black president, which is very telling. It's a very telling thing for them to say, because they feel like he's not sticking up for them. I'm not sure how much power he has to intervene in a local clash like that. And he did initiate an investigation into it, which did result in the finding that that police force was systemically racist. Mm-hmm. But then every investigation into every police force in America has come up with that same in every city all over the entire country, from Los Angeles to, you know, I mean everywhere. Mm-hmm. So it's a problem in the entire nation. And I think you know, like mm-hmm. you were saying, It's a nation that's never really dealt with slavery.
Absolutely.
They made it illegal, yep, 150 years ago, and then they never really got rid of it.
That's right.
And they've just changed it into a system of, you know, oppressive policing and,
yeah,
and marginalization, and it's you know, it's that system that's carried on, and
seems that
we're
her
people
head.
Are just now saying we're not going to put up with this anymore.
And then fast forward to today's president, we have,
yep,
Donald Trump,
oh, no,
who has been criticized for encouraging police brutality, saying that, yeah, the police are being too nice. What do you think of Trump's role, Lee, in race relations and police brutality?
Well, Trump is the original white Anglo-Saxon Protestant white privileged man in chief. He uses the bully boy pulpit in Charlottesville. He backed the fascists. He seemed completely unapologetic for the murder of an anti-fascist demonstrator by fascists in that area. He subsequently made his views known in relation to Muslims and African-Americans. I mean, there can be no doubt. There are lots of people saying, oh, well, maybe Donald will mature with age or somehow become more nuanced by the politics of Washington. He's become more extreme, more discriminatory, and in fact encapsulates the very worst aspects of a sort of white supremacist, male, bigoted patriarchy that has somehow, through the dint of wealth and corruption found its way to the top job.